Dr. Mosley, what do I do now? That question was asked of me a number of months ago by the wife of one of our students. She was crying when she asked it. In fact, I spoke with her several times during those months, and every time when I did, she was sobbing. Her husband had just resigned his pastorate effective immediately and had abandoned her and their two daughters. I tried to pray with her and counsel her as best I could. And she said, Dr. Mosley, you don't understand. And she called the name of one of the most prominent pastors in our denomination. And she said, my husband was his protege. I never looked at my husband as just another pastor. He was the godliest man I knew. His heart was hot for God. His preaching was passionate. He wanted nothing more in life than to lead people to Christ and to grow a great church. It is inconceivable that this could have happened. And yet it did. What do I do now? I asked her about the circumstances of his resignation and leaving his family. She said that there had been a time of growth in their church. People had been coming to Christ in the past, but lately it seemed there had been no fruit. Things in the church had become difficult. And he had become discouraged, and so he quit. Things had become difficult. He grew discouraged, and he quit. And by the way, what she suspected at that point later was confirmed. He left her for another woman that he had met on the internet. Well, what happened to this young man, I'm sure you're painfully aware, is not unique. A lot of men and women in the ministry immerse themselves emotionally and spiritually in the work to which God has called them, but at some point the work becomes difficult and they give up when the work is only half finished. Well, the same thing happened about 2,500 years ago under the leadership of Nehemiah in Jerusalem. And I invite you this morning to look at some parallels between that project of rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem and the work to which God has called us. During his early years, Nehemiah had been the cupbearer to Artaxerxes, king of Persia. He received word about the situation in Jerusalem. His brother told him that the people were greatly distressed and the walls were still in ruins and the gates of the city were still charred from the fires of battle. It had been almost 150 years since the Babylonians had demolished those walls, but still they had not been rebuilt. About 13 years before, Ezra had led a group of Jews back to Jerusalem to restore the holy city to its former glory. And they had rebuilt the temple, but when they saw it, its appearance paled in comparison to the beauty and the majesty of the Solomonic temple. And now, still, the walls that had protected the holy city lay in ruins. After Nehemiah heard about the condition of the walls and the distress of the people, he prayed for 4 months about what he might do about that. And one day, King Artaxerxes asked him, and Nehemiah told him what he wanted to do, to return to Jerusalem, the homeland of his faith, and rebuild the walls. Well, miraculously, Artaxerxes, the man who had stopped the work on the walls years before, gave him permission to do so. And so Nehemiah returned to Jerusalem. After he got there, he continued to pray and investigate the situation. And the Bible says that God put a plan into his mind. And he shared the plan with the people, said, let's rebuild the walls. And they enthusiastically agreed and rose and put their hands to the work. And they gave themselves to the work until quickly the walls were half finished. Then they looked around them and saw the amount of rubble that remained. The stones used to build the first half of the wall had been readily available. They picked it up off the ground and put it on the wall. But now, the workers were tired. But before they could continue to the work of construction, excavation had to be done. And the people had to also face the harsh reality that the opponents of the project had not gone away. And so their enthusiasm began to cool, and the magnitude of the task began to frighten them. They were half finished, and many of them were ready to quit. Well, you and I have also been called to a challenging task, have we not? We're called to be like Jesus in the way we live and even in the way we think. We're called to make disciples of all nations, to be God's salt and light in this world, and to equip the saints to be disciple makers. That is also a great task. And you know that is the calling of your life and God's command to you. And I pray that quitting when you're half done is not even in your mind right now. You cannot even conceive of that. I pray that you'll enter ministry like I did when I began my first pastorate in South Mississippi when I was 24 years old. I was so confident of the call of God on my life, so confident in my own omnicompetence and my ability to do anything that came along. I could not conceive of a day when I would arise in the morning and be anything other than exhilarated to go to work that day. But have you noticed how easy it is for us to imagine ourselves easily and successfully completing a task until it's actually our turn to do it? That was the problem of the Jerusalemites. They had a great vision for the walls being completed, but the work became hard. This past weekend, my family and I were skiing up in West Virginia. My wife and I were chaperones for the youth ski retreat in our church. Every time I go skiing, it reminds me of the first time I ever went skiing. I was a sophomore in college, Alvin, and some friends and I went up in a bus to the Poconos, and I shall never forget riding in the bus up to the slopes and looking out of the windows of the bus, seeing those skiers come down in the slopes and thinking to myself how easy that looked. And I imagined myself cutting turns at Olympic speed and passing those other skiers on the way down the slope, with the people on the bottom of the slope looking up at me, marveling at my form as wisps of snow trailed behind my skis. That was my mental image. And then I got to the top of the mountain and looked down. Nothing could have prepared my 20-year-old hard head for just how steep that was. I was raised in South Alabama. I'd never skied, I'd never hardly seen snow, and I'd certainly never seen a mountain that high. We wouldn't call that a slope in Alabama. That was a cliff. First thing I thought, I remember when I was on top of that mountain, is what they had said about those ski lifts. You can ride them up, but you can't ride them down. And I knew I was going to have to ski down. That was the only way I could get off the mountain. Well, I did think of one other way, and I prayed for the rapture, but the Lord tarried, and so I knew I was going to have to ski, and I heard that you don't just ski straight down the mountain. You ski over to the side here, and you turn, and you go back and so forth so you don't build up too much speed. And so that's what I did. I skied over here and tried to turn, and I fell down. I skied over to the other side, and I tried to turn, and I fell down. I skied over to that side, and I tried to turn, and I fell down. Every time I tried to turn, I fell down. So I finally decided turning is no fun. So what I'll do, I'll just point my skis down the slope, and I'll go for it. And of course, if you've ever been skiing, you know it's not difficult to build up an enormous amount of speed if you're going straight down the hill. And so that's what happened. I found that it's not difficult to stay up on your skis as long as you don't try to turn. But I was going very fast. I hadn't learned that if you get in trouble, you just fall down, you know. So I tried to slow down. But by that time, I was near the end of the slope, and the slope was iced over, and I couldn't slow down. And so I was going at breakneck speed on the bottom of the slope. There was a line for the ski lift there. I skied through the line in the ski lift over somebody's skis right in front of their face. There was the area where they were putting on their boots and skis. I skied through that as well. And then the area where people were standing around looking up at the slopes, I skied right by the onlookers there. And the only thing that stopped me, I'm telling the truth, is my skis ran into the parking lot, and when they hit the asphalt, they stopped and threw me between two parked cars there. And there I lay like a roach, you know, on my back. I couldn't get up until a nice man came along and said, "Would you like some help?" And he pulled me up. Well, let me ask you something. Why did I go headlong into something I knew virtually nothing about? Because it's always easier to see how you can successfully and easily complete a task until it's actually your turn to do it. And that was the Jerusalemites' problem. God had put the plan into Nehemiah's head, and he had shared it with the people, and they caught the vision, and they enthusiastically began the work. Just as I envisioned my easy success at skiing, they envisioned the easy and successful completion of the wall. But after working hard, they were tired, and they saw that much work was yet to be done, and so they were ready to give up. Surely all of us at some point have arisen with zeal and put our hands to the work to which God has called us. But somewhere along the way, we became keenly aware that to continue working would be difficult. We'd have to face opposition from the world, conflict within ourselves, temptation from demonic forces, and even the disappointing behavior of those who call themselves Christians. And the longer we stay at the task God has given us, the more we realize those difficulties are not going to go away. So it often happens that one who has been a faithful servant of God in the past sees the difficulties in the future and he gives up. Hey, this is one of the reasons that a lot of Christians are spiritually immature today, and a lot of churches are not regularly and enthusiastically reaching people for Jesus Christ. At some point, they realize that the going ahead would be difficult. The sacrifices, great. The opposition, hard. And so they quit when the work was half done. They were supposed to keep growing and giving, but somewhere along the way they plateaued and they settled for a mixture of spirituality and carnality, for a mixture of wholehearted service for Christ and half-hearted service for Christ. They stopped. Hey, it happens all the time, even to seminary students. In fact, one study revealed that 10 years after seminary, those who entered ministry, half of them are no longer even in the ministry. So I think it's worth our time this morning to submerge ourselves in this text and ask what caused the Israelites to want to quit, and then see their desire to quit, and then also the cure for this desire to quit. The first cause that wanted them to stop work on the wall was fatigue. The workers were tired. In verse 10, Nehemiah wrote, "In Judah, it was said, the strength of the burden bearers is failing." Some commentators have suggested that these words and those that follow were a song that the workers sang, and the Hebrew is in poetic form. When I was growing up, my father and I did a lot of work together, and he taught me a song that originated, I think, in the coal mines. You ever heard it? 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. It's a depressing song when you think about it, but anybody who's worked long and hard at something and sweated with little progress, they understand the message of that song, and that was the same message that was being said or sung in Jerusalem when they were tired. They worked hard. They were excited about what had been done. But when they stopped to think about how much work was yet to be done, all they had to do was feel their tired muscles and think about the sacrifices that had to be made. And it wasn't long before they were singing that woe is me song again. Now we should say at this point that it's no sin to feel tired or even to be discouraged. But those feelings must never be allowed to derail us from what God has called us to do. Maybe this morning that you're tired of sharing the gospel with little results. Maybe this morning that you've been praying for someone and their salvation or their spiritual growth. You've been working with a group of Christians and they seem resolute in their resistance to any spiritual growth. And that's got you worn out. Maybe you've been working and giving in some ministry, and right now you're just tired of it. Well, some of the Jerusalemites were ready to quit, and the cause was fatigue in serving the Lord. What is the cure for fatigue? Now, it may sound strange, but the cure for fatigue in serving God is to continue the work. Return to the work. That's the only way We'll develop endurance. That's the only way we'll bring back the joy of the work. Well, the people of Jerusalem became tired, but there is no indication in the text they ever stopped the work. In fact, there is every indication they did nothing but continue the work. They were tired, but they didn't stop. Not long ago, I noticed how out of shape I was. I got tired too easily, and I noticed that my stamina was low. Well, what do you do when that happens? I got to thinking, you know, I'm going to be digging in Hatzor in the hot Israeli sun this summer. I better do something about that. So what do you think I did? If you get tired too easily, you know, well, you know exactly what I did. I decided, well, I get tired a lot. It's obvious what I need is more rest. So I started, you know, getting to work about 9:30 in the morning, taking a midday nap, getting off about 4 in the afternoon, sleeping 9 or 10 hours a night. No, of course that's not what you do when you're out of shape. I've been dragging my carcass out of bed at 5:15 in the morning or staying late at work in the afternoon to go down to the fitness center and run on the treadmill or in my neighborhood. That's how you build up strength. That's how you build endurance physically. Well, listen, the same way you can experience physical fatigue, you can experience faith fatigue. And the worst thing you can do when you experience faith fatigue is to give up or quit or stop working. What am I saying? I'm saying that if you want to be a strong person in leading people to faith in Jesus Christ, then you have to exercise yourself in the area of evangelism. Amen. If you want to become a strong prayer warrior, then you have to log in some time on your knees. You don't give up. You return to the work. That's how you become strong. That's the reason Paul wrote, "We exult in our tribulations because tribulation produces perseverance, and perseverance proven character." It's a reason the writer of Hebrews wrote, "Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." And he also wrote, "You have need of endurance so that at the end you will be given what is promised." We need endurance so we'll be able to say at the end of life what was said of Joshua's life. He left nothing undone of all the Lord commanded. Quite a testimony, isn't it? Left nothing undone of all the Lord commanded. But to be able to have that testimony, we need endurance. Well, staying at the work is the way to build endurance. In the midst of serving God, in the midst of being tired, the worst thing we can do is quit. And yet, some Christians did that long ago, and they wonder why serving God just doesn't have the attraction that it once did. They didn't realize how much it would cost them to quit. So I came here this morning to say that while you're working in the will of God, while you're doing what He's called you to do, it's always too soon to quit. Return to the work. People of Jerusalem were rebuilding the walls and they were considering quitting when they were only half finished. One cause was fatigue, but that did not cause them to stop the work because of it. A second cause was discouragement. They were not only saying in verse 10, the strength of the burden bearers is failing, they also said, yet there is much rubbish. Well, they'd quickly organized and gathered the stones that were laying around and built the wall to half its height, but then they saw that they were going to have to become garbage men and they were going to have to clean away the rubbish now. And, you know, that can easily cause you to be discouraged. They had begun with a great vision of the rebuilt walls of Jerusalem, and now all they can see is rubbish. Listen, if you can stare at the rubbish long enough in your life, you'll become discouraged. It's easy to lose your vision and become discouraged if you got a pile of trash that you had to clean up surrounding you. It's that way in every area of life. You got a 2-year-old, you're praying that'll be a great servant of God one day. It's easy to lose that vision when you walk into that 2-year-old's room and see that he's covered every inch of it with a thin layer of baby powder. By the way, I'm not making that up. Our 2-year-old did that 15 years ago. You're serving in a city and you pray that there'll be a heaven-sent revival there, but it's easy to lose that vision when all you see is crime in the streets and corruption in the government and carnality in the churches. You've got a vision of a great church growing, people being born again, and people going out around the world as gospel bearers, and yet it's easy to lose that vision when you look at all the problems in the church. Hey, if we stare at the rubbish long enough, it's easy to lose our vision and want to quit. pastor not long ago in Virginia came home from vacation and saw that nobody had cut the grass at the church and the parsonage while he was gone. He became so depressed they institutionalized him for 3 days. Then he was discharged, and at the end of that, he resigned his church and left the ministry. Hey, beloved, we're going to have to realize that we live in a world in which sometimes nobody's going to cut the grass. Sometimes we're going to be surrounded with rubble. All we see around us is rubbish. What's the cure for that kind of discouragement? The cure is to remember what's really important. See, the reason people get discouraged is they start focusing on the problems, the rubble, instead of what is really important. What you do with the rubble is you carry it away and get back to the work. What was the work to which God had called the Jerusalemites? It was to rebuild the wall, and Nehemiah kept reminding them of that. That's made clear in verse 15. In spite of all the difficulties in rebuilding the wall at this point, the result of the difficulties was that all of us returned to the work, each one to his work. Well, for the people of God in this church age, God has given us the task of making disciples of all nations. And the way to overcome discouragement in the work is to remember that at the end of the day, that is what is really important. See, in the midst of ministry, it's not that hard to forget what's really important. Through the years, I've asked a lot of pastors, "Hey, how are things going in your church?" And sometimes they'll say things like, "Man, things are going great. We revised the Constitution and bylaws this year." Or, "You know, we finally carpeted the adult floor department last year." And you know, the sarcastic side of me always wants to say, "Well, praise God from whom all blessings flow. I know we'll reach this generation for Christ now." See, I know this sounds judgmental, but you show me a pastor who thinks the best thing that's happened in his church in the last 12 months is the revision of the Constitution and bylaws, and I'll show you a pastor who's forgotten what's really important. For the people of God, what's important is leading people to God. When I served church over in Durham, as Alvin said, we had a computer technician come over one day to work on our computers, and I began to share the gospel with him, and I could tell he was uncomfortable talking about his relationship with God, and so finally he just said, "I'd rather just leave the conversation limited to business." You know what I said to him? I said, "John, this is our business. The only reason we have a church on this corner is to get people to God. That's the only reason we have computers. It's the only reason we build buildings. It's the only reason we pay parking lots, to get people to Jesus Christ so they'll go to heaven instead of hell. By the way, that's the only reason we have a seminary here, too." 3 years ago, Dr. Patterson asked me to come to this ministry. And after we agreed that it was the will of God, but before I actually came, I had begun receiving reports from Dr. Patterson on what was going on in the denomination, since I'm supposed to be aware of that sort of thing. Never told Dr. Patterson, but the first report I got of that month's giving to the cooperative program, a cold chill went down my spine, and I thought to myself, "Oh my soul, what have I done in accepting this?" Denominational bureaucrat. And in those days of preparation for the transition from the local church to the seminary, I had to promise God that I'd never be satisfied doing the business of a school and not doing the business of the kingdom. And I had to stand up in front of my church family publicly and tell them that in the future, I won't merely be an administrator at a school. I promise you, I'll always have the names of lost people on my prayer list, and I'll be praying for them to be saved, and I'll be sharing the gospel with lost people. I told them that despite the fact that some worldlings might possibly be impressed with my vice presidential title, that they could count on the fact that in the future I'd be preaching the gospel like a holy roller somewhere every time I had the opportunity. Why? Because that is what is really important. not the administration of a school or church, not the accumulation of knowledge, not even the assurance of continued employment, but loving lost sinners and getting them to God. That is what is most important. And if we can remember that, then it'll help us in the midst of our discouragement. Why? Because instead of staring at the rubble, we remember the objective. God hasn't called us to be rubble starers, but world changers. And we get our eyes off the rubble and remember what God has called us to do. If you stare at the rubble long enough, you know, some cranky deacons or some crabby church members or lack of funds, you're going to get discouraged. It'll happen every time. But if you remember what God has called you to do, you can forget about some of the petty problems. Well, they were considering quitting because they were tired and discouraged. The cure for fatigue is to stay at the work. The cure for discouragement is to remember what's really important. But they were also considering giving up because of a loss of confidence. Notice that the people rebuilding the wall also said, "And we ourselves are unable to rebuild the wall." Well, of course they were able to rebuild the wall. They built the first half, they could build the second half. But you know, it's easy for us to be so objective about their ability to rebuild the wall, separated from the difficulties as we are by 2,500 years or so. No, their hands had become paralyzed by the work, and their hearts had become paralyzed by fear and discouragement. And that's when they said, "We are unable." Do contemporary believers say the same thing? Of course they do. When I pastored over in Durham, we came to the conviction the Lord led us to have $1.5 million renovation and building project. And if I had $1 during that time for everybody said to me, "We can't," I believe I'd have had $1.5 million. We can't. I can't. I won't. Well, I told our people, thank God we've not undertaken an easy task for Him, one that we could accomplish in the flesh. We're going to have to depend on His miraculous provision in order for us to do this, to be animated and motivated by His Spirit in us. Hey, here's the cure for a loss of confidence. Rely on God to provide where He guides. See, God was the one who put the plan in Nehemiah's mind to rebuild the wall. Nehemiah had said that God was the one leading the project all along, and we could go through the book of Nehemiah to see at every point Nehemiah was reminding the people of the greatness of God and the fact that the project originated with Him. When the wall was completed, in fact, Nehemiah wrote, "When all our enemies heard of it and all the nations surrounding us saw it, they lost their confidence, for they recognized that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God." Not by our own strength, but with the help of our God. Hey, let's admit this. When the people said, "We are unable," they were half right. They were unable to complete what God had called them to do in their own strength. But they were never intended to complete it in their own strength. They were intended to rely on the presence and power of God. And that's why Nehemiah kept reminding them of that. So really, this loss of confidence is not that bad after all, as long as we're losing confidence in our own ability and we're regaining confidence in the ability of God to help us. As long as we're moving in the direction of doing the will of God and relying on His providential care to provide for us along the way. See, I think that sometimes when we say, "I'm not able," what we really mean is, "He is not able." Not only am I unable, He is unable to make me able. But we should never forget Philippians 4:13 is in the book. "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." In fact, sometime you ought to go through the New Testament and underline all the places where it says that God is able. Hebrews 7:25, "He is able to save forever those who come to Him through Jesus Christ." He's able to save. Hey, He's able to sanctify. Jude 24, "Now to Him who is able to keep us from stumbling and to present us before His glorious presence blameless and with great joy." He's able to save and to sanctify. You say, "Dr. Mosley, those are spiritual things. I've got physical needs." The Bible also says He is able to provide. He is able, 2 Corinthians 9:8 says, "to make all grace abound to you, so that always in everything you'll have an abundance for every good deed." Here's what I'm saying. When we find ourselves in a situation similar to the Jerusalemites rebuilding the wall, when in the midst of working for God we find ourselves tired and discouraged or having lost confidence in our ability to continue, that's when we should remember that our God is the one who created and sustains this universe. He is the one who parted the Red Sea and caused the walls of Jericho to fall. He's the one who healed the diseases of His people and caused them to go through the fiery furnace and the lion's den and even defeat the grave itself. And if He can do that, then He can help me too. Learn to rely on His strength. We are unable, but God is able. Another cause of quitting too soon is opposition. Verse 11 states, "Our enemies said, 'They will not know or see until we come among them, kill them, and put a stop to the work.'" In other words, the enemies of this project plan to secretly attack those who are working on the walls. And the people of God had opponents. Does the work of God in this world have opposition today? Sure it does. Josh McDowell from this pulpit just a few weeks ago reminded us, I think accurately, that we don't live in a post-Christian world anymore. We live in an anti-Christian world. I shall never forget reading a few years ago what Frank Zappa said about the church. He said, "Hey, when you see those cars with that little fish sign on it, that's the enemy." That's the perspective of a lot of people in our world today. Oh, we have opposition today. There'll be opposition from outside the church, even opposition from within the church. Well, what do? When we face that kind of antagonism, what did Nehemiah do? He readied the people for opposition, and he resumed the work. Look at verse 13. "I stationed men in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, the exposed places, and I stationed the people in families with their swords, spears, and bows. Nehemiah organized and armed the people to protect one another." But look also at verse 16. "From that day on, half of my servants carried on the work, while half of them held the spears, the shields, the bows, and the breastplates." In spite of this imminent threat of attack from their enemies, the work never stopped. Nehemiah readied the people for opposition, and he resumed the work. Later on, Nehemiah's enemies once again tried to stop the work, and he said, "I'm not going to come down from the wall because I'm doing a great work." Nehemiah refused to be derailed from the work to which God had called him by opposition from the enemies of God. When I think of that, I'm reminded of Billy Graham. Billy Graham is so venerated today that many people either don't know or they've forgotten the bitter criticisms that were aimed at him in the early days of his ministry. In 1954, he preached his first London crusade. It exploded into South England, and thousands of people were born again. On the heels of that, 1,700 churches from 31 different denominations in New York City asked Graham to come and preach his first New York City crusade, and he said yes. Then came the criticisms. Came from the secular press and from the religious left and from the religious right. For example, Reinhold Niebuhr, writing in the Christian Century, wrote, "The forthcoming crusade is a trumped-up revival which would spin along its own kind of triumph because canny, experienced engineers of decision have laid the tracks, contracted for the passengers, and will now direct the traffic. The Graham procedure does its mechanical best to succeed whether or not the Holy Spirit is in attendance. In this strange new junction of Madison Avenue and Bible Belt, the Holy Spirit is not overworked, He's overlooked." That kind of scathing criticism came to Graham from the left, while on the right, Bob Jones Sr. and John R. Rice put out false rumors, forbade their church members to pray for Graham, and said God was not in it. In the midst of that criticism being fired at from the right and fired at from the left, Graham did not even stop long enough to answer his critics. Instead, he simply did what God had called him to do. He preached the gospel to lost people. And the result was that tens of thousands of people were born into the kingdom in the New York City crusade in an evangelistic effort that will be talked about 100 years from now. Billy Graham had his opposition. Nehemiah had his. Paul was opposed. And if you think Jesus didn't have opposition, then how do you think he managed to get himself crucified? Now, if we think we will avoid opposition, then we're deluding ourselves, or we're pathologically naive. We will have opposition. What will our posture be toward that opposition? Must I be carried to the skies on flowery beds of ease while others fought to win the prize and sail through bloody seas? Sure, I would fight if I would win. Increase my courage, Lord. We will be opposed, but we have to make the commitment now that when it comes, we will ready ourselves for opposition and we will resume the work. All the people of Israel were ready to quit. They were tired, they were discouraged, they had lost confidence, and they were being opposed. But there was one more problem. Some of the people were ready to quit because of fear. The rumor that the soldiers were going to attack from every direction spread among the Jews like wildfire. Some of them were obsessed with the possibility of attack. Nehemiah wrote in verse 12 that some of them came to him 10 times to warn him. 10 times they came to him again and again. Can't you just see the worry, the panic on their faces as they said to Nehemiah, Nehemiah, they're coming. I know they're going to be here. What are we going to do? We've got to do something. Over and over again they did that. In verse 14, Nehemiah mentioned, I saw their fear. See, at this point, Nehemiah really had two problems on his hands. One was the opposition of the enemies. The other was the fear of the people of God. The icy fingers of fear had clutched around their hearts and their faith had been frozen. Well, what do you do when the enemies of God are antagonistic and the people of God are afraid? Well, you don't quit. What did Nehemiah do? He stationed guards to protect them from the enemy, but he couldn't protect them from their own fear. The cure for that problem is to rest in God's providential care. He will take care of you. When Nehemiah saw their fear, he said in verse 14, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome. Verse 15, we read that this immediate plan to attack was abandoned for two reasons. First of all, our enemies heard that it was known to us. In other words, if they were planning a secret attack, that was no longer possible. And secondly, Nehemiah wrote that God had frustrated their plan. Now, we don't know exactly what God did to frustrate their plan, but what the text evidently teaches is that God somehow sovereignly engineered circumstances so that their plan was not going to work. Of course, we'll face opposition, but when it comes, we can't face it with fear. We face it with faith instead in the sovereign God who has the power to frustrate the plans of those who oppose His work. That doesn't mean He'll carry us to heaven without any opposition or difficulties, but it does mean that He'll see us through if we put our lives in His hands. He may not take away the opposition, may not ever even explain why it's there, but He will do two things that are even more important. Number one, He'll use the difficulty to build your faith in Him. And number two, He'll use you through the midst of the difficulty to glorify His name. Now, on the other hand, He won't do either one if we're so busy whining about our fears that we don't stay at the work and trust Him to see us through. Last year I was at the pastor's conference at First Baptist Jacksonville. I sat down in their crowded cafeteria to eat, and a few minutes later a man asked for permission to sit down there with me, and I welcomed him. And when he found out that I was here at the seminary, he said, you know, that's amazing. I was at Southeastern Seminary when I was a little boy, and my father was a student there. My father left a lucrative career at age 40. God called into the ministry, and we went to the seminary. He said, one day when I was 9 years old, my mother found a tick in my hair, and she took it out, but she took me by the doctor's office to make sure she had gotten all of it. And while I was there at the doctor's office, he saw a lump on my throat. And after numerous tests, they found that it was Hodgkin's disease. He said, I was 9 years old when I heard that it was Hodgkin's disease. I ran straight home and I looked in the encyclopedia under Hodgkin's disease, and I read all about it, and I saw that the last sentence in that entry was, there is presently no known cure for Hodgkin's disease. I said, you know, that must have been a lot for a 9-year-old to handle. He said, yes, it was, but you know, it was difficult on our whole family. Because I had to start going over to the University of North Carolina Hospital for treatments, and they were very expensive, and I had to go over there for 5 years. And I said, how in the world did your seminary dad pay for all that? He said, well, it wasn't easy. Our home church helped us a lot, and there was a gospel quartet that did a benefit concert for us, and friends helped, and somehow we made it through. You know, I started thinking about that father going to classes and seminary, worrying about his son at home, by the way, one of his six children that he brought with him to seminary. I started to think about him trying to study and take tests and make the grade, wondering if he could meet the needs of his family and this one son who was so ill. And I asked Kevin, I said, did your dad ever think about quitting, just giving up? And that's when he began to cry. He said, my father desperately wanted to quit. In fact, he prayed that God would just let him somehow fail a course so he could use as an excuse to get out and go home and forget about it, go back to his career. But somehow, he made it through, and today I'm free of Hodgkin's disease. No more remnant of the disease at all. I'm well. I said, you know, that's a miracle. He said, yes, it is. But you know, I think he said the greater miracle is that my father survived. He made it through that time. He refused to give up. He went on to pastor two churches over 25 years, and now he's retired. And my dad has been my example my whole life because he stuck with it no matter what. In fact, God's called me to the ministry now, and I'm minister of youth at a church down in South Carolina. This morning, the man who told me that story is Kevin Darnell, and he's in his first semester at the seminary where he had Hodgkin's disease as a little boy. He's back here in the back of the chapel this morning. God called him to pastor a church just Sunday before last over in Smithfield. You know, I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say that all the people that God uses him to lead to faith in Christ will in some measure be the fruit of his dad who refused to give up, even though he was tired and discouraged and fearful and had lost his confidence and ability to meet the needs of his family and his own needs.